Radio, the series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution.
Greetings, this is Ellen Kamai, the natural nurse, co-host of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Dr. Eugene Zamperone and I are deeply involved with indigenous cultures and combine traditional knowledge with the latest research in natural health care. Join us each week on PRN.FM from 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time every Tuesday or anytime on the archives. Each week, we'll bring you authors, professors, researchers, and activists who are committed to bringing you the latest information which you can use to ensure maximum wellness for yourself, your cells, and your family. Tune into PRN.FM every Tuesday, 10 to 11 Eastern Standard Time, or listen to the archive at 1-701-719-0884. This is Ellen Kamai, the natural nurse, hoping that you stay healthy.
Thank you for listening to PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
It's just not enough.
Oh, oh, man. My loving God. Can't get enough of your love, baby. Girl,
live from New York City, it's the Gary Noel Show. And now, your host, Gary Noel.
It's like the more you give, the more I want. And maybe that's no lie. Oh, no, babe.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Noel, on the road. We'll be back shortly. Have a lot to share today. Always starting with the latest on health and healing, always from mainstream independent science. So at least if I'm sharing something with you, you can go to the source, verify it for yourself, and see that we have a great deal of positive research showing us that healthy selections provide a longer life. But today I'm going to take on several issues. The first, right now. I've posted a very short clip. It's only 2 minutes, and there's no talking to it. I posted it on PRN.FM. That's PRN, Progressive Radio Network.FM, PRN.FM. Watch it right now as I'm doing my opening comments, and then I'm going to ask you to call in and give me your feedback. What does it mean to you to see this? I was doing a lecture yesterday. I'm in the final 3 days of a one-month retreat. And this is a time when people are beyond their detoxing and rejuvenating. They're into a very mindful place, relaxed, at peace with themselves. And as I said, you want to look in the rearview mirror of your life and see nothing. You want to see your life ahead of you. But to do that, we have to deconstruct without reliving some of those moments that we wasted. Excuse me. Some of those moments also that we should have spent more time being mindful of the people and animals in our lives. And I recalled an incident where a friend of mine had a dog that just loved this person beyond imagination, like most dogs and cats do. And I once was remarking, why don't you ever bring your dog out for the race walking, you know, as you train in the morning? Well, you know, I take her down to the park. I said, no, dogs love to get out. They need to get out. They need to get out and run. They need a lot more exercise than what you might imagine. She disagreed with it because it would have been an inconvenience to her schedule. And this went on for years. And then one day, I get a call, and she was very sad that her dog was going to be put down that day. I said, why? Well, I can't carry it out, and its legs are not working, and the vet said it's best. Put it out of its misery. I said, I can work on that. I've helped a lot of dogs and cats and birds and horses that people thought were going to die, and they got their health back. No, and then she put it down. Then she was feeling sad about it. And I said, you're not the one who should feel sad. The animal that you neglected is what should feel sad. That was the last time she spoke with me. She didn't like the fact I actually brought a reality to her attention. A lot of people don't. You know, they're always good friends to you. Tell them something they don't want to hear and then forget it. I think we have to be reminded of how precious friendships are. Any form of relationship that contributes something of love, unconditional love to us, we should never take for granted. We should appreciate it, honor it, and be there for it. That said, now watch this. I assure you, you have not seen anything like this before. It'll touch you. If you got a heart, it'll touch you. Just go to prn.fm. Watch it, and then call into my talkback line. I'll take calls in about 15 minutes at 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. Also today, I want to go a little further. I'm going to start bringing together some different lines of historical reasoning. Because when I mentioned that today's technology, even though it's offering some wonderful promises, and some of those promises I believe will not be highly conditional, won't be based purely upon profit, but others will be. And the trouble is when you have something that you're told could be helping you and they take your DNA, now are you aware that they own your DNA? They own it. And you better be aware of the consequences, legal consequences and health consequences of that. So I'm giving you the picture of who are these people, not all of them, but who are the leaders of this whole genetic movement, this molecular biology movement. And I've had to go back in history and bring you forward to show you how they constructed all this, how they controlled the media, controlled the comments. I'll continue with that today. But also today, I was recalling how when we were being led up to believe that Muammar Gaddafi was evil, a Hitler, and had to be destroyed, much like we were told Saddam Hussein. By the way, there's no comparison Gaddafi and what he did for Libya and Saddam Hussein and what he did for Iraq. And then Assad, the same people, wrong every time, never right about anything, causing massive death into the millions of displacement and harm and death. Never held accountable. Well, that was just 6 days ago that was Gaddafi's when the United States and its allies, and I was thinking some of the allies, who caused us to go in and destroy an entire nation, making it a complete wasteland today? Think back. The names Nicolas Sarkozy, little punk, Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, the architect, our modern Marie Antoinette, David Cameron, remember him? And the King of Saudi Arabia, the King of United Arab Emirates. Yeah. My personal belief, they should all be tried for war crimes and crimes against humanity. But then it got me thinking, what can I do to share some insights about the fact that this is not the first misstep in foreign policy and its impact upon another country where the entire nation of Great Britain can give a about the consequence of what it did, the entire history of Great Britain for at least hundreds of years has been based upon conquering. Now, how bad can it get? How bad can a country be to another country? You're going to get a history lesson today, a really powerful history lesson, all accurate, all pure scholarship. And I want to thank the good people over at Serbian FB Reporter for their outstanding research on this. So we're going to take a look at this. Never been held accountable, never apologized, and yet there are monuments to the person who caused this, and those monuments should be having a different story of the suffering of this nation written down. So that's our history lesson for today. I'm also, either the next day or two, I'm going to give you a conversation about why I believe that there should be a great deal of focus upon what is left, if anything, of integrity, honesty, decency, or a desire for left-wing democratic politics to honor the working class, to protect those who've been economically and politically abused by the owners of the means of production, and to live to some higher principle. Maybe, let's say, Henry Wallace. Don't know who Henry Wallace is? He was selected by FDR for his third term vice president. Now, let me tell you why the left today has lost all of its integrity, all of it. Because we would not have had a Cold War, the Korean War, the Vietnam War, the United Nations. None of that would have existed had it not been for the betrayal of the American democratic class, the liberal class, who wanted Henry Wallace, but he wasn't to be chosen. Instead, Henry Truman was chosen with less than 2% support. And I'll bet you don't know how this happened. Well, you will. You're going to find out the exact way that the Democrats stopped him from being put into nomination. That would have been FDR's last run at president, and how Henry's name was not put on up for vote with just 5 feet. 5 feet, a man that I actually had on this radio program, a legislator, Claude Pepper from Florida. What would happen? He was 5 feet from the microphone when the nearly hysterical Merrill Kelly proceedings and to nominate Wallace before the bosses forced a history lesson in adjournment against the will of the delegates. I'll tell you more about that later, because I'm sure no one knows about this. Now, think of the Democratic Convention where they brought in a token progressive, a token. And so people thought, oh, good, we're going to have some good progressives. Nothing. There was nothing progressive at all. And nothing applied, nothing acted upon. Last night, in a tie, 50-50, the Vice President, Mike Pence, broke it on the side of the bankers, the corporations, the credit card companies. You can't now, if you find that they're guilty of having engaged in a massive fraud against you and the public, you can't bring a class action lawsuit. You would expect that from the Republicans. Well, sooner or later, listen to what I'm saying. The truth about our vice president's background is going to become evident. Let's see how he handles it. I think someone's going to have an interesting moment. It's the vice president. That's all I'll say at this moment. Now let's go to the issues at hand. You see, we have a lot to talk about. First, on health and nutrition. Is daydreaming good for you? Now, this is from Georgia Institute of Technology. A new study from the Georgia Institute of Technology suggests that daydreaming during meetings isn't necessarily a bad thing. In fact, it might be a sign that you're really creative. This is from the study. Quote, people with efficient brains may have too much brain capacity to stop their minds from wandering. This is what they're saying. And they did some MRI imaging and asked people to focus upon what was important to them. And the people who people let their imaginations go, the people who were thinking beyond the environment they were in, frequently had very creative brains. Let's put this in a different perspective. It's not just your capacity to daydream, it's what you're daydreaming about. That's what makes the difference. I have sat in classes that were so boring, and there was nothing I was going to learn, so I daydreamed. But I daydreamed about things that I wanted to do. I'd sit and write. In fact, when I'm on trips, I'll just sit there, even if I don't have something to write with, and I like to write in longhand. I'll write and use that time purposefully. So if you're daydreaming about something you'd like to do, something you're constructing in your mind, something that gives you passion, pleasure, creativity, that liberates you from the limitations of the environment you're in, that's a good thing. If you're simply allowing your brain to wander, that's not a good thing, because you might have as many as 55,000 different random thoughts per day. So it's not just daydreaming, it's what are you dreaming about? Are you constructing ideas? Are you putting together constructs that are positive, that empower you? Because even if you were the poorest person in the world, even if you were a prisoner in a cell, they can't control your brain. So where they're looking at you and think, we got you, you can't go anywhere. Your mind can. Your mind's not limited. So we should always use the opportunity when we have in the right circumstances to let our brains rip, let it go free, and see what great things can come from it. Separately, from the University of Alabama, I'll bet a lot of people in this audience eat bananas and avocados. I hope you do, because they're good for you. But how good are they? According to their study, it's really good for your heart. A study from the University of Alabama at Birmingham found the more potassium in your diet, the less likely your arteries will harden. Now, we know that when your arteries harden or calcify, that's called arterial sclerosis. When they start to get damaged and blocked, that's atherosclerosis, or a combination of the two. So when you're eating bananas, you're getting more of the nutrient that you need to lessen the elevated hardening of the arteries. And potassium can be found in potatoes, avocados, and spinach. And, quote, the study could lead, quote, uncovered mechanisms that offer opportunities to develop therapeutic strategies to control vascular disease. So I would suggest that you try to get at least one banana. Apricots are good also. Sea vegetables are good. Kale is good. But then supplement with 500 milligrams. You generally get them in 99 milligram tablets. Take about five of those days. And here's the deal. If you're suffering from any form of disease, including cancer, you don't want a lot of sodium in the diet. That sodium actually contributes to cancer. Sugar contributes to cancer. You want potassium. So make sure you get more potassium. There's a new study out of the United Kingdom from Strathclyde University. And here researchers are exploring how to enhance brain activity through light stimulation, light, L-I-G-H-T, in the hope of advancing new strategies to prevent Alzheimer's disease from developing. Now, the study is investigating new ways in which buildup of a protein, you've heard me talk about it, it's toxic to brain cells, it's known as beta, B-E-T-A, amyloid, A-M-Y-L-O-I-D. The amyloid plaque is bad, but could this be halted with the use of high light stimulation in areas of the brain, which are particularly vulnerable to Alzheimer's? So scientists at the university, in a 14-month study, are studying exactly that. Now, here's what they don't know, and I'd be happy to share my documentary footage with them. So if we have anyone from the university listening now, and we have people all over the world listening, this is at the Strath, S-T-R-A-T-H, Clyde, C-L-Y-D-E, University in the United Kingdom. I've just completed a review of the scientific literature. Most importantly, I have now on film a demonstration of light therapy by one of the most brilliant scientists I've ever met. And he was able to take any number of people who had degeneration of the lower spine, all forms of seizures, all forms of brain disabilities from Alzheimer's to Parkinson's, and also ulcerated conditions on the disc, herniated discs, which is very painful, frequently become infected, requiring a very bad surgery. It's bad because it generally is not very successful. And then you end up with secondary complications from orthopedic surgery. This was able to eliminate that. Now, it's too complicated to discuss at this time. but it's based originally upon Royal Rife's technology. Royal Rife was a genius, and he was the person who originally, without computers, but he developed refractory light, meaning taking spectrum of light, measuring the frequency of how fast that vibration was vibrating, taking a tumor, measuring the frequency vibration of the tumor, matching the light frequency with the tumor frequency, and that would kill the tumor. And he did the same thing with viruses. In fact, I've asked the person, would he put together a protocol with some physicians in the field of virology to do it with people with hepatitis, Epstein-Barr virus, herpes, including herpes 6, one of the most deadly viruses, and see whether or not he's able to succeed. And he said he would. So I'm looking forward to that. But this man has already had success. So research you're doing now for 14 months, this is way beyond what you're doing. And so happy to put you in touch. I have it all on film, and it's part of a new documentary I'm doing. And again, I'm explaining to this audience, this is cutting-edge stuff. This is way ahead of everyone. Also from Stellenbosch University in South Africa, they've taken a look at the gut microbiome in post-traumatic stress disorder. And so when people say, I have this gut feeling, I have this terrible, you know, pain in my gut, you know, there's actually more than a metaphor there. Why? The bacteria in your gut could hold clues to whether or not you'll develop post-traumatic stress disorder after experiencing traumatic events. Now, we know the post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, is a serious disorder that can develop after a person experiences a life-threatening trauma. However, not everyone exposed to a traumatic event will develop this, and several factors influence an individual's susceptibility, including the living conditions they're in, childhood experiences, genetic makeup, and the type of emotional support system they have. Well, in recent years, scientists have become aware of the important role of microbes existing inside the human gastrointestinal tract. These are called gut micro, M-I-C-R-O, biome, B-I-O-M-E. Now, these microbes perform important functions such as metabolizing food and medicines and vitamins and herbs, fighting infections, breaking down fiber, creating even more good probiotics. It's now believed that the gut microbiome also influences the brain and brain function by producing neurotransmitters, meaning hormones, and immune-regulating molecules. And in turn, stress and emotion can change the composition of the gut microbiome. Here's what it means. Let's say you have a stressful event. Your stress hormones, like cortisol, can affect bacterial growth and compromise the integrity of the intestinal lining, which can result in bacteria and toxins entering the bloodstream. That in turn can cause inflammation, and that inflammation has been shown to play a role in several psychiatric disorders. This is from the study. Quote, our study compared the gut microbiomes of individuals with post-traumatic stress disorder to those of people who have experienced significant trauma but did not develop trauma-exposed conditions. We identified a combination of three bacteria that were different in people with post-traumatic stress disorder. And so that's very important. So individuals with post-traumatic stress disorder had significantly lower levels of those bacteria compared to trauma-exposed controls, meaning who had trauma but didn't have adverse effects. Now, if you had trauma during childhood, you also had lower levels of two of those bacteria. Quote, what makes this finding interesting is that individuals who experience childhood trauma are at higher risk for developing post-traumatic stress disorder later in life, and these changes in the gut microbiome possibly occurred early in life in response to childhood trauma. So what does this mean? How can we benefit from this? Well, understand, those bacteria actually control much of your immune system regulation. And when you have an increase in inflammation in the body, arthritis, diabetes, cancer, those are all pro-inflammatory. It also impacts your brain functioning and your behavior. We don't feel good when we have that gut feeling. We don't feel good when we have, you know, any form of stress. So levels of inflammatory markers are crucial, and that's something we should be doing now, is checking a person's biome. That's very easy to do. But then putting in the bacteria that they were deficient in, these three, that's easy to do. These are not uncommon. And that's why when you're detoxifying and cleansing and then taking fresh juices, especially the green juices, and especially ginger and chlorophyll-rich, such as chlorella, spirulina, wheatgrass juice, and then vitamins like vitamin C all together, you're creating new immature stem cells. And then the bacteria can be replenished. The good bacteria can be replenished every day, 10, 20, 30, 40 billion per day. Then you give up the sugars and you give up anything contributing to the bad bacteria. Now you've got good bacteria. So you're going to have better communications in your gut. You're not going to have that sick in my gut feeling, sick to my stomach. How many times have you heard sick to my stomach? Well, the stomach is actually the gut. It's all connected. It's in the same region. And also, how many times in life did we hold our anger or fear or our pain in our gut? So with humanistic counseling, with some therapy such as tapping therapy, which is really terrific. I just filmed Grayson, Dr. Grayson, who is the founder of the tapping therapy, down in his office about a month ago, just before I came to the retreat. And he was doing this 30 years ago. And it's putting yourself in a mindful place, understanding you can release the energy, and then saying certain words and tapping it. I'm just telling you what it is. I'm not saying this is how you do it. You have to get proper training. But I've seen people who had long time trauma gone, and it stayed gone. I followed them. In fact, for that particular episode, I filmed someone 5 years ago, and I waited 5 years to re-film the person and Dr. Henry Grayson. And it works. So now put the two together. You put people in an environment where there's positive support system, and you rebuild their gut bacteria with the ones they've been missing from childhood. And now you can overcome the childhood trauma, no more post-traumatic stress disorder. And I'm working with some people right now. I mean, people who have not had any help, zero, and really wrecked their lives for the last 60 years from Vietnam. I chose some Vietnam vets. I've already worked with vets from all the different conflicts. The vets I'm working with now with post-traumatic stress disorder, at the end of 3 days now, you'll hear what they went through. But this is exactly what I've been doing, helping them at the humanistic level, helping at the biological level, and that's what this study is showing. It's got one piece. Good for them. Good study. I support it. Now they've got more to that, and I'm happy to help any researcher, any academic around the United States who needs these kind of insights, because we're doing cutting-edge stuff. I mean, it's out there, and it's working. That's the latest on health and healing. We're going to take a brief break and come right back. Please stay with us.
Before
I ask you at the beginning of the program to take, that was almost a half hour ago, to take just 2 minutes and watch a video to see what did it mean to you. Did you connect with it and in which way? And how can that give us a better appreciation of what it means not to take anyone or anything for granted? If you're lucky enough, fortunate enough, blessed enough to have good friends, family, relationships, pets, all that in time passes. So we should never have to live with regret of what we weren't doing, where we weren't at, when we should have been there. So I want to see, take a moment and call us now, 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. And while you're thinking about what to say, I want to share some history. As some of you know, over a period of time, I like to give you a little different look of history, one that's not in the textbook. And because at no time has Great Britain apologized to the world for these crimes against humanity. And then I was reminded this morning about how David Cameron was instrumental, as was Tony Blair, getting into Iraq. If Tony Blair said no to George Bush, we're not going to support you, it's unlikely that Bush would have gone ahead the way he did. Cameron the same way. I will tell you the things about Muammar Gaddafi's background on an upcoming program that you did not know. I'm not talking about the fact that he had the longest-lived people in Africa, the longest lifespan, longer than Americans, the most highly educated group and people in Africa, 54 nations, countries, his long and most educated, more so than the average American, by the way. But I want to show you what he did leading up for 40 years that we're not ever giving him credit for. But shouldn't we make people aware of the true nature of some of the individuals going into countries? I'm going to quote some things now. Yet, quote, if the history of British rule in India were to be condensed into a single fact, it is this. There was no increase in India per capita income from 1757 to 1947. Wow. Churchill explained why he defended the stockpiling of food within Britain while millions died of starvation in Bengal. And he told his private secretary, quote, the Hindus were a foul race, protected by their mere pollinations from the doom that is their due. Meaning he blamed people for starving to death instead of that Great Britain stole all of their food and took it to United Kingdom. During its 190 years of looting and pillaging the entire Indian subcontinent, it all underwent at least two dozen major famines, which collectively killed millions of Indians throughout the length and breadth of the land. How many millions succumbed to the famines, no one knows exactly. However, the colonial rulers' official, Great Britain's official numbers indicate a mere 60 million deaths. Let me repeat that. But in reality, it was higher. Great Britain, the rulers of Great Britain, the members of Parliament, the Queen, caused 60 million of their serfs, in effect, their peonage colony, to die. Now, who was and should be known as one of the greatest genocidalists of history? Right up there with Hitler, Stalin, Mao. In fact, he caused more deaths than Stalin and Mao. He was known as the Butcher of Bombay. He was the British East Indian Company's Baron Robert Clive. And if you want to see what he looks like George Washington, you can go into Google and Google Baron Robert Clive, C-L-I-V-E. There's a painting by Nathaniel Dance of him. Understand that British colonial analysts cited droughts as the cause of fallen architectural production that led to these famines. That's what you're reading in textbooks today. I want to tell you all textbooks that in any way skirt responsibility for what happened are lies. British rulers were fighting wars in Europe and elsewhere and colonizing parts of Africa, and they were exporting grains from India to keep up their colonial conquest. While famines were raging, people in the famine-affected areas, resembling skeletons covered by skin only, were wandering around, huddling in corners and dying by the millions. So this should not be understated. One of the worst genocides in history, right up there with the American and North and South American destruction of the native population, which is estimated to be up to 100 million, but certainly more than 60. But why does this tie into something I've been playing each day on depopulation and eugenics? Because the British are up to their eyeballs in believing in eugenics. This is a systematic depopulation policy. And in the year 1750, India's population was close to 155 million. That's India's population. At the time British colonial rule ended in 1947, undivided India, that means you had Pakistan and Bangladesh and Greater India all together. Then after that, there was partitioning. You had 390 million. In other words, during those 190 years of colonial looting and organized famines, India's population rose by 240 million. And since 1947, during the next 68-year period, India's subcontinent's population, including those of Pakistan and Bangladesh together, have gone up to about 1.6 billion. 1.6 billion. India alone is about 1.3, about equal with China. They're all neck and neck. Thus, despite poverty and economic depravity in the post-independent Indian subcontinent, during those 68 years, population has grown by at least 1.2 billion. Now, records show that during the post-independent period, the subcontinent has undergone drought conditions in parts of the land from time to time, but there was no famine. Now, although thousands still die in the subcontinent annually due to the lack of adequate amounts of food, a poor food distribution system is the cause, political corruption is the cause, genetic engineering is a cause, and lack of sufficient nourishment is a cause. Displacement of people off their lands for large-scale development is a cause. It's also to be noted that before the British colonial jackboots got firmly planted in India, famines had occurred, but with much less frequency, only about once every 100 years. There was indeed no reason for these famines to occur. They occurred only because the empire engineered them, intending to strengthen the empire by ruthless looting and adoption of an unstated policy to depopulate India. This, they believed, would bring down the empire's cost of sustaining India. Take, for instance, the case of Bengal, which is in the eastern part of the subcontinent where the British East Indian Company had first planted its boots in 1757. Now, the rapacious looters, under the leadership of Robert Clive, the man I mentioned a little while ago, a complete degenerate, an opium addict. There is a little bit of karma, tiny. He blew his brains out. In 1774, in the London Berkeley Square residence he had procured with the benefits of his looting, got control of what is now West Bengal and Bangladesh and Bihar and Odisha. And in 1765, he took control of all that. At the time, historical records indicate, and these are not Indian records, these are British records, India represented close to 25% of the world's gross domestic product. Who was number one? Well, that would have been China. And while Britain only had a paltry 2%, remember this is before the Industrial Revolution, and Bengal was the richest, most prosperous of all the Indian provinces. So how is it that millions died of starvation in the richest, most prosperous of all of India's different areas? Well, following his securing control of Bengal by ousting Nawab in a devious battle at Plassey, Clive placed a puppet on the throne. He paid him off. And like all the Rajas were paid off. And he negotiated an agreement with him, with his person to become the sole tax collector, meaning the man he put in charge will collect taxes from everybody. And then he left the nominal responsibility for government to his puppet. Now, that arrangement lasted for over 100 years. So as more and more Indian states were bankrupted to facilitate future famines, the tax money, all of it, went to British landowners and bankers, to the British government. All the while, millions upon tens of millions starved to death in Bengal and Bihar. Now, Clive was made a fellow of the Royal Society in 1768. And by the way, his statue still stands near the British Empire's center, evil center, Whitehall. For any of you visiting Great Britain, and there's a lot of things to see there. Remember, if you believe that, I don't believe statues should be torn down, because if statues were built to honor racism, then what we have to do is keep the statue, but then have a public proclamation where people can go and read it, or better still, to have audio phones like you have in a museum, where you go and look at the statue and hear the true story of what the statue and its the person being advanced in history really represented. So people go, wow, I didn't know that. That gives me a whole different perspective. But if you take away the statue, then there's a whole element of history, true history, we will not know. And I believe that you should know this when you go by there and take a look at this. And then maybe you could write a letter and say, shame on you, the British government, the entire British government. There are some decent people, but those who control are not decent. Here's what he has. This is on record. All right, this is what he said when he was asked before British Parliament of abusing people in India. Quote, this is him, Clive. Consider the situation which the victory of Plassey had placed on me. A great prince was dependent upon my pleasure. An opulent city lay at my mercy. Its richest bankers bid against each other for my smiles. Was there any reason for the famine to occur? Was there any legitimate reason for the attack on Benghazi? Was there any reason for the invasion of Libya? Was there any real reason to be in Vietnam, to invade Afghanistan, since none of the people who were part of the attack on the World Trade Center came from Afghanistan? Was there any reason, real reason, to invade Iraq? Is there any real reason to invade Syria? Any real reason at all? The answer is no. Not if the British had not wanted it. Bengal then, as now, harvested 3 crops a year. It's located in the delta of the Gangetic Plain, where water is more than plentiful. Even if drought occurs, it does not destroy all 3 crops. Moreover, as was prevalent during the Mughal days and in earlier time, the surplus grain was stored to tide the population over if there was only 1 or maybe 2 bad crops a year. There's still a third. But the looting of grains carried out by Clive and his gang of bandits and killers drained everything from Bengal. It resulted, just there alone, 10 million deaths. It's called the Great Famine. It eliminated 1/3 of the entire population of Bengal, the most prosperous, the richest agricultural center in India. It should be noted that Britain's much-touted Industrial Revolution began in 1770. The very same year, people were dying all over Bengal. The Boston Tea Party that triggered the American Revolution had taken place in 1774. The Boston Tea Party made the empire realize that its days in America were numbered, and that led Britain to concentrate even more on organizing the looting of India. The prime reason why these devastating famines took place at irregular intervals and were allowed to continue for years was the British Empire's policy of depopulating its colonies. If these famines had not occurred, India's population would have reached 1 billion people long before the 20th century arrived, and that meant that it would have been a disaster for Britain because they couldn't have fed those people, they couldn't have overseen those people. So to begin with, the larger Indian population would mean larger consumption by the locals. That would deprive the British Raj, R-A-J, by the way. These were the local rulers, all of whom were serving Great Britain, a greater amount of loot. The logical way to deal with the problem was to develop India's agricultural infrastructure. But that would only be to the benefit of Great Britain. And that means that it would have more money to run its colonial and bestial empire. It would also develop a healthy population which could rise up and get rid of the abomination called the British Raj. So these massive famines also succeeded in weakening the social structure and backbone of the Indians, making rebellions against the colonial forces less likely. In order to perpetuate famines and thus to populate the what he considered heathen or the dark Indians, the British imperialists launched a systematic propaganda campaign. They propped up the fraudster Parson Thomas Malthus, I'm sure you've heard of him, and promoted his non-scientific gobbledygook. What'd he write? The Essay on Population? My God, he'd fit right in today. People who believe in population control. Here's what he claimed. Quote, "This natural inequality of the two powers of population in the production in the earth, and that the great law of our nature," there's your manifest destiny, "which must constantly keep their efforts equal, form the great difficulty that it appears to me insurmountable in the way to be perfectibility of society. All other arguments are of slight and subordinate consideration in comparison to this. I see no way by which man can escape from the weight of this law which pervades all animated nature," end quote. What he's saying is, God's on our side, we're stronger, wiser, better educated, you're poor, you are a burden to society, so we do not hold you as sacred. Oh, and by the way, just so we're all clear, crystal clear, Malthus was an ordained in the Anglican Church, and the British Empire made him a paid economist of the British East Indian Company, which, with the charter from Queen Elizabeth I under his belt, monopolized trade with Asia and colonizing vast tracts of the continent using its well-armed militias fighting under the English flag of St. George. So Malthus was picked up at the Haileybury and Imperial Service College, which was also the recruiting ground of some of the worst colonial criminals. Let me think. My God, Harvard, Yale, Stanford. Yeah, my goodness. And you thought that we didn't have something representing a breeding ground for technocrats, spoiled, indulgent brats that go immediately to Washington or Wall Street or wherever they can find that promised land. So some of his alumni, well, Sir John Lawrence, Viceroy of India from 1864 to 68, Sir Richard Temple, Lieutenant Governor of Bengal, and later Governor of Bombay Presidency. So while Parson Malthus was putting forward his sinister scientific theory to justify depopulation as a natural necessary process, the British Empire collected a whole bunch of other economists. Well, let me see. Economists. They don't have anything to do in America. Economists. What the hell do they do? Let me think. They tell us that everything's good. Hey, debt is good. Thrive on debt. No. How'd that work out for Linens and Things and Circuit City? And what about the 58,000 factories that closed since 2000? Couldn't have anything to do with debt. No. And the people who were the Malthuses of our times, hedge funds, all these scumbags. Yeah, they the same mindset. Equity Partnerships, who are on the board of PBS. Tells you a lot about PBS's integrity. Yeah, write a big enough check and we'll bring you in and put you on a board. One of my classmates in high school became a curator. One of the curators at the Museum of Modern Art. She came over one day and she said, "I'm so disgusted." Why? Because people have no background in art, are complete cultural illiterates, will sit there and write out a check for $100 million and suddenly they're praised. And it's an embarrassment to what true art is. We understand. Well, we sure know that they had people who were their progenitors and people they could look up to if they look backwards. So they had a whole breeding school in the British Empire of economists. The people who absolutely saw the head of the Federal Reserve, Alan Greenspan, he saw the crash coming and warned everybody. No, he forgot. But he had 20,000 economists at his beck and call. Yes, they all forgot. But they saw the collapse in 2000 coming. No, they missed that. The dot-com bubble was surely at 23,000 and growing. They see that it's a complete fraud. All of Wall Street is a fraud. The entire scheme is a fraud. The gross domestic product of Wall Street has nothing to do with the rest of the country. The money it makes for itself is never to buy factories, to give interest-free loans to small businesses, to invest in people. It's just to make money for itself. So surely its notion of economy is no different than the British. No, they're right in there with the same group. And free trade? Yeah, they had free trade back then. Free trade played a major role in pushing through the empire's genocidal depopulation of India through the British Raj's efforts. In fact, free trade is the other side of the Malthus population control coin. By the time the Great Famine of 1876 arrived, Britain had already built some railroads to India. Good. Hey, I like that. No. The railroads, which were touted as institutional safeguards against famines, I like that. No. They were instead used by merchants to ship grain inventories from outlying drought-stricken districts to central depots for hoarding. In addition, free traders could control the prices. So when you had a shortage of grain, then they would charge more, but they wouldn't sell it. They wanted even more. So while millions of people were dying, there was food all around. Not today, but an upcoming program, I'm going to pay homage to my heritage. I'm Irish ancestry and track it way back. In fact, my brother and I are going to go over there in about 6 months and go to the original towns that my family came from. I've never met them personally. I want to. And at the time where we had the great Irish famine, where more than 2 million people died, there was 27,000 shiploads taken out of Ireland to Great Britain. It again was depopulation by intent. So what we have is we had in India at that time, we had lots of food, but it was being hoarded. And the British Raj knew or should have known, even if the British rulers did not openly encourage this process, they were fully aware of it, and they were perfectly comfortable in promoting free trade at the expense of millions of lives. This is how Mike Davis describes what happened. I quoted him earlier, quote, "The rise of prices was so extraordinary and the available supply, as compared with well-known requirements, so scanty that merchants and dealers, hopeful of enormous future gains, appeared determined to hold their stocks for some indefinite time and not to part with the article which was becoming such unwanted value. It was apparent to the government that facilities for moving grain by the rail were rapidly raising prices everywhere, and that the activity of apparent importation and rapid railroad transit did not indicate any addition to the food stocks of the presidency." In lay language, keep running those railroad trains, take grain from the poor, bring it to here, we'll hoard it, we'll tell people there's a shortage, and that way wherever we take it, whoever we sell to, they're going to pay a lot for it. Oil prices. Let me think. That couldn't happen there, would it? Citigroup. Is that a bank? What is Citigroup? I've heard the name somewhere. Citibank. Is that a real bank? Were they involved in fixing prices? Did they not use any oil but bought oil and caused the price of oil to go up? Now, there was another person that cooperated with them. So when we were paying $115 a barrel, it should have been about $48 a barrel. Wow. It wasn't a railroad and it wasn't grains, but it came out the same thing. There are many great famines. I only gave you the Bengal famine, 1770. But I could give you other famines. The Chalisa famine of 1783 to 84. The Dojibera famine, or what was called the Skull famine of 1791 to 1792. And hyper death rates there. The Upper Doa famine of 1860 to 1861. The Orissa famine of 1866. The Rajputan famine of 1869. The Great Famine of 1876 to 78, the Indian Famine of 1896 to 97, and then again in 1899 to 1900, and that affected Bombay, Madras, the Bengal, United Provinces, the Uttar Pradesh. Yeah, millions died. The Bengal famine of 1943 to 44 that I mentioned that Winston Churchill orchestrated, he personally was responsible for the death of at least 5 million people. He's right up there with Adolf Hitler. And so it goes. Oh, and their relief camps? We'll put up relief camps. Relief camps. Were they actually concentration camps? Yes. Why is that not in the British textbooks? It should be. I'll tell you about that on an upcoming program. That was the action of Viceroy Lytton's deputy, Richard Temple, another of the Haileybury products imbued with the doctrine of depopulation as the necessary means to keep the empire strong and vigorous. Just like there's a whole lot of people that meet at Davos and other places saying, we want the environment to be clean. Good. I'm with you. We want people to be healthy and not have global warming destroy us. I'm with you again. Now, how do you intend to do that? Oh, sterilization? Vaccines? I see taking large swaths of land in Africa under good cause, good names. Bono shows up. He'll show up for anything, it seems, if it looks like it's good. But does he ever actually have the intelligence to go deep enough into a topic to learn the truth? And then all those people, what about the hundreds of thousands of people I'm going to tell you about on upcoming programs that have been thrown off their land already? Who's the land? Well, this is economist kind of guys, you know, the ones from Yale and Harvard and Stanford and Columbia. Wow, aren't we lucky to have those pristine bastions of decency and ethics? Not so much. But that's another story, and it's coming at you. I'm Gary Nall. Thanks for listening. Have a nice day.